everyone, and welcome to the Free Movement Podcast. This is your April roundup, and I'm your host, Sonia Lennigan, joined as ever by my co-host, Colin Yeo. Colin, how are you today?
I'm fine. Weather's good. It's not cold anymore. It's nice and warm and sunny. I'm good, thank you.
Good to hear. Okay, so we're going to start with asylum, and the first article we're going to cover in some depth because it's really long, because it's really complicated. Colin, I don't know if you remember, like before Easter, I think you were really worried that I was in the middle of a nervous breakdown. I was writing this then because obviously we thought the act was going to pass then, and I was just trying to wrap my head around it all and figure out exactly what would happen and how the processes would work. So it took ages, and then obviously I had some breathing space afterwards while the act was going back and forth between Houses of Parliament. Anyway, the Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Act 2024, as everyone I imagine is aware, received royal assent on the 25th of April, and it came into force on the same day because it was always to come into force after formal ratification of the UK's treaty with Rwanda, and that also happened on the 25th of April. It is really, really important to remember that much of the Illegal Migration Act is still not in force. I know everyone's fed up of hearing me say that, but I also don't care because I still see people getting muddled over this. Really, really important. Although I don't know how much longer I'll be able to say this because I think it was last week or the week before, some draft tribunal procedure rules were published, and those say that they are to come into force immediately after the coming into force of Section 2, Duty to Make Arrangements for Removal of the Illegal Migration Act 2023. Obviously, if and when that happens, I will be flagging that up to everyone as soon as possible. Okay, so in my briefing on the Safety of Rwanda Act, what happens now, I have set out just what the process should be now, essentially. And there was a load of guidance that was published last Monday, the 29th. So I sort of updated what I'd already done in light of that new guidance. First of all, I looked at who is at risk of being sent to Rwanda. And the new inadmissibility guidance says that a person could face removal to Rwanda under this policy where they are eligible for inadmissibility action under the guidance. And one point I want to flag up on that is that the inadmissibility guidance says that caseworkers can refer cases to be considered for inadmissibility action at any time before a substantive asylum decision. And that includes after the substantive interview, although the guidance does say that in general, cases are more likely to be suitable for inadmissibility action close to the time of arrival in the UK. The next thing is that they must have claimed asylum on or after the 1st of January 2022, and their journey could be described as having been dangerous. That is generally understood as being either a channel crossing or someone coming in a lorry, and the person does not have families with children under the age of 18. The guidance also says that people who arrived in the UK after the 9th of May 2022 will be prioritised, and that date is the date that the inadmissibility guidance was first updated to include Rwanda. Then I also set out in the briefing, not in a lot of detail, but in some detail, the fact that there are two different legal frameworks for inadmissibility. So that's another thing that lawyers need to be very aware of. There's inadmissibility for people who claimed asylum before the 28th of June, 2022, and then inadmissibility for people who claimed on or after that date. And that is when the Nationality and Borders Act put inadmissibility process into primary legislation, and they did things like remove the right of appeal, whereas before the 28th of June, certification is needed, and that is all set out in the guidance and in my briefing. To some extent, I've also linked to some earlier briefings we've done on inadmissibility. Then I looked at notice of intent and extensions of time. This is a really, really important point. So the inadmissibility guidance says that anyone under consideration for Rwanda will be issued with a notice of intent stating this. They are then given 7 calendar days if detained and 14 calendar days if not detained. And I have seen reports of some people getting these notices where they are not detained. So they have that time to respond to the notice explaining why their claim should not be deemed inadmissible and why they should not be sent to Rwanda. the notice of intent must tell people that they can apply for an extension of time to respond. And it's really, really important that people ask for that. 7 calendar days if detained is not going to be enough time. 2 weeks if not detained, that's not going to be enough time to find a lawyer, get the lawyer to understand your case and respond in full to the notice of intent. That's particularly the case when you look at the sort of evidence that the Home Office is expecting a person to provide in order to resist being sent to Rwanda. So really important to ask for extension of time. One point on that that I also want to flag up is that the guidance says that rejection of a request for an extension of time can be made within the inadmissibility decision if it will be made promptly, but then promptly is not defined. So that means that a person could be waiting for a decision on their extension of time request and then instead receive a decision that their claim is inadmissible with a refusal to extend time provided then. But presumably that would then be liable to a challenge on the basis of fairness. Next, I looked at responding to a notice of intent where Rwanda is the named destination. And this is where new guidance was published on the 29th of April, setting out how they will consider these claims. Because the Safety of Rwanda Act says that, I think it's section 2, it says decision makers must conclusively treat Rwanda as a safe country. But then section 4 still provides for individual decision making in relation to the decision to send someone to Rwanda. And that says that decisions can be challenged based on compelling evidence relating specifically to the person's individual circumstances. And so the guidance, the new guidance that was published, sets out what they expect in relation to compelling evidence relating specifically to the person's individual circumstances. So the notice of intent will invite representations as to why inadmissibility action is not appropriate, and then also anything that is relevant to that person relating to the safety of Rwanda. So that is, you need to look at that so you know what needs to go into the response to the notice of intent. Then I looked at timescales for the inadmissibility decision, which is that there aren't any. But a procedural thing that I wanted to flag up is that generally the Home Office will serve the inadmissibility decision and the removal decision at the same time. So that is something to be aware of. The guidance says that they will probably do that. And so, yeah, I just want to flag that up as well. Then I also set out the content of the inadmissibility decision, what the removal process is. Extensions of time are also relevant in there, so it's important to be aware of that as well. Then I looked at what happens if the decision to remove a person to Rwanda is maintained. And the challenge to that is judicial review, where you've also had the inadmissibility decision at the same time, then you're going to be challenging both together. The judicial review guidance was updated on the 29th of April, and it has a new section, which is called Safe Third Country Removals. This says that a judicial review will not by itself prevent removal, as is often the case if you're dealing with a normal removal, unless it's a charter flight. The guidance says that as Rwanda is considered safe, the person can pursue their judicial review from there. So that's all fine. The guidance does say that where interim relief is granted, removal must not take place. And if an oral hearing is listed to consider interim relief, then removal must not take place until after that hearing, assuming interim relief is not granted. However, the ability to get interim relief is where the Safety of Rwanda Act again becomes significant. This is because it limits, but does not completely eliminate, the ability of the courts or tribunal to grant interim relief, which would prevent removal. Section 4.4 of the Rwanda Act restricts the court or tribunal from granting interim relief unless the person would face a real, imminent, and foreseeable risk of serious and irreversible harm if sent to Rwanda. That is obviously a high test. If interim relief is instead obtained from the European Court of Human Rights, the Act also provides for a minister to decide that that will be ignored. The judicial review guidance says that a person must not be removed while a ministerial decision on the Rule 39 order is pending. And obviously, well, obvious to me, because I've been following all of this stuff pretty closely, there is a judicial review that has been brought by the FDA union, which represents civil servants, and that is being listed, after bragging that I know everything, I can't remember the dates. It's June. I think it's 4 to 7 June. it's listed for a day in there, but check the weekly newsletter. I put it in there. So that is the first judicial review hearing that has been listed. Asylum Aid have also sent a pre-action letter in relation to the Safety of Rwanda guidance. Again, we have an article explaining all of that. As things change, it seems to have slowed down this week, which is nice, but I will just keep writing it all up and getting it out there. So just keep an eye on all of that. And then the one last thing that I wanted to flag up on barriers to removal is that the impact assessment on the Migration and Economic Development Partnership with Rwanda, that's the Equality Impact Assessment, this says under MPs' representations that it is a long-standing parliamentary convention that MPs' representations suspend removal until a case has been considered and a response issued to the MP. In practice, representations are responded to swiftly and do not usually delay removal. Given the novel nature of the SORB, I can't remember what that stands for, something about sending people to Rwanda, obviously. Safety of Rwanda bill, I suppose, yes. They haven't updated that bit yet to reflect as an act. We may expect future Rwanda cases to attract significant attention from MPs, and responders may be overwhelmed by cases, causing a delay or removal to be cancelled pending a response. Write to your MPs. If you have someone who has been threatened with this, get their MP involved. Because, you know, if the Home Office is worried about this happening, then it seems like a good thing to do. So that is it. And that sort of leads me on to the next thing I wanted to cover, which is our article.
Well, I've got a couple of things I wanted to ask about, actually. One thing to just sort of say and one thing to ask about. So the one thing to say was I think it's interesting, the Safety of Rwanda Act on interim relief, and it doesn't go as far as the IMA, the Illegal Migration Act, because I think I'm right in saying the Illegal Migration Act, Section 54 or something like that, basically completely prohibits interim relief that prevents removal, whereas the Safety of Rwanda Act doesn't. So it's kind of before the IMA comes into force, they've got there is the possibility of interim relief, but after it comes into force, there kind of isn't, actually, by the looks of things. Is that right?
That is correct. I think, yeah, I want to say it's maybe Section 55, but anyway, there is a reason, yeah. I've left all of that stuff out of my briefing, because it's not in force, and
yeah.
Like this is absolutely complicated enough, and I have seen very smart people getting themselves tangled into knots,
yeah.
Overthinking the Illegal Migration Act is in force when it is not. So everyone ignore Colin.
Okay. That's useful advice for life generally, I think. The other thing I wanted to, so I had a question as well, which is the Asylum Aid Judicial Review. Now, we're speaking on the 9th of May. This stuff is just changing all the time. Have you got any idea when that's going to be heard and what the impact might be?
Well, it was the pre-action letter has been sent. I don't think that they have lodged yet.
They're challenging the guidance, aren't they? They're saying that the guidance on how you interpret the sort of the pathfinding for officials as they're making decisions on Rwanda, they're saying the guidance is basically wrong on that, I think, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, we watch this space. They did very well in the Rwanda challenge the first time around with the fairness point, which is proving to be really important here. And I think there's potentially... we're potentially going to see more litigation on that point unless the Home Office behaves as it should in relation to these extensions of time. But yeah, we'll wait and see. It makes my head hurt a bit, to
yeah.
be honest.
Yeah, me too. I think there's a challenge, the challenge in Northern Ireland to the whole IMA is due out next week, I think, so like Monday or something.
Yeah, I think it's the
13th. I can't imagine that's going to succeed, but we'll sort of see when it comes out. Before you resume again, just thank you so much for going through that, Sonia. That's so helpful. I really just wanted to kind of give you a chance to catch your breath before you moved on to the next item.
Yes. Well, now you've seen it, you can understand why I was in such a state before Easter.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the next one is one of my favorite topics, which is inadmissibility. So Monica at Asylum Aid, one of the Monicas at Asylum Aid, has written an article for us on how to get clients out of inadmissibility limbo and into the asylum system. So I have been going on about this for months now, and I am just completely delighted to see that the judicial reviews are going in, and they seem to be going in numbers. Do not wait until it gets to the point of the Home Office trying to send your client to Rwanda. Get those challenges in now, get them into the system now. In the last week, Rwanda has said they only have capacity for 200 people to begin with. They haven't given any timescales on when that will be increased, but 200 is not the number of people we have waiting in inadmissibility, and they cannot be left there forever. This article explains some of the different ways that the process can be challenged and challenged successfully. And I am also going to flag up that we have the wonderful Jed Pennington from Wilson's, who actually, I should say, he sense checked that article for me, my briefing on Rwanda, again, back when I was in the bad times before Easter. So a huge thank you to Jed for that. And he is doing a webinar for us on the 22nd of May, which is looking at challenging inadmissibility and getting people into the system. Loads of people have already signed up. I'm actually going to be on holiday then, so I haven't decided whether I'll dial in from the beach in Greece or just catch up with the recorded version later. But that's going to be pretty unmissable, I would say.
Right. Thanks, Sonia. So the next item is mine. And this is to do with the Nationality and Borders Act. So the Upper Tribunal has given us some guidance in a reported case called JCK against Secretary of State for the Home Department, Botswana, 2024 UKUT 100 IAC. And it's about the standard of proof before and after the Nationality and Borders Act came into force with effect from the 28th of June, I think it is, isn't it? Now, this is one of those absolutely insane things that the Home Office has done. It's kind of totally scraping the bottom of the barrel of pointlessness, basically, because all of this, all what we're saying now, only applies to refugee claims. It doesn't apply to human rights claims. So it's just totally pointless. It doesn't make any difference to the actual outcome, just the sort of type of status that you get, not whether you get status. So it's to do with what's now called, what we're calling the split standard of proof. And basically, if you've made a claim or in certain circumstances, certain transitional provisions, been in contact with the Home Office before the 28th of June 2022, then the old rules apply to you. But if you made the claim after that, then the new rules apply. And this is set out in Section 32 of the Nationality and Borders Act. And it basically says that there's a split standard proof in the sense that the balance of probability applies to establishing whether there's a convention reason under the Refugee Convention applicable in your case. So whether you have a political opinion or whether it's been attributed to you or you are of a certain religion and so on. And also to the question of subjective fear, which is a weird one to sort of come back. So this is sort of stuff that we thought was really well established in refugee law, you know, going back to kind of Hathaway's book in the 91 or something like that. You know, the idea that a refugee has to have actual fear is pretty outmoded. I don't think there are any major jurisdictions that actually take that approach, that you've got to be literally afraid. Most jurisdictions say, well, actually, it's about apprehension. It's about, you know, when you say you fear it's going to rain tomorrow, you mean you apprehend that it's going to rain tomorrow. The new legislation appears on the face of it to require actual subjective fear, although I don't think we've necessarily seen the last word on that. I think, you know, when it goes, if this case goes or this issue goes beyond the Upper Tribunal, we might see the Court of Appeal or Supreme Court deciding differently on this issue. But basically, yeah, the balance probability applies to that as well. So for example, if you're a kid who doesn't understand, if you've got mental health issues that mean that you don't understand, then apparently this rules you out from refugee status if you cannot experience subjective fear or whatever. But then after that, the issue of risk on return, that's the traditional standard of a reasonable degree of likelihood. So whether there's a risk of harm, whether there's absence of state protection, whether there's internal flight, internal relocation alternative, and so on. So it's kind of the balance of probabilities to past stuff, basically, and then the conventional standard to future risk. But like I say, it doesn't apply to human rights claims, only to refugee convention cases. So it's all a bit nuts and pointless. Okay, and I think I've got a double hander as well. So I'm coming on to the next item as well. This one is a case that Sonia wrote up, and I don't know why you've given this one to me. It's possibly because you're so angry. I was going to say you're so cross about this. That's kind of understating things. I think it's such an awful case, basically. So it's a person who had indefinite leave as a refugee, who went abroad and they were unable to return to the UK, and in fact are still unable to return to the UK over 15 years after the Home Office made a mistake, basically. Entered the UK a long time ago, got refugee status, has a Refugee Convention travel document, has ILR, goes abroad because he's been diagnosed with tuberculosis and thinks the hot climate is going to help, goes to Djibouti. And then he ends up losing his travel document, ends up in Ethiopia, seeks assistance from the British Embassy, but the Home Office haven't kept a proper record of the grant of ILR. Now, there's no question that they did grant ILR because of the nature of his travel document, and also they later concede this issue. But because they can't find the record, officials at the embassy basically don't accept that he had ILR, and they refuse to help him. And he's been in Ethiopia ever since. So that's it's like 2008. Which is just amazing. And it's impossible to imagine this happening. It's impossible to imagine this happening to somebody white, quite frankly. You know, I just think he just was never taken seriously by the looks of things. And you relate this in your blog post, Sonia. His mother eventually managed to scrape together enough money to pay for lawyers because we're not cheap and there's no legal aid. The first tier tribunal then, sorry to put it like this, but they screw it up basically, and they find that there's no such thing as. But essentially, they're finding that there's no human rights engaged in an entry clearance application, even though the guy had legal status and his family was in the UK and he was a refugee and he's got no legal status in Ethiopia and so on. The upper tribunal on appeal just don't pay any attention, and it goes to a cart judicial review, incredibly. The Court of Appeal call this a most extraordinary case and are pretty scathing, really, of the first tier tribunal's treatment of this and also of the upper tribunal's treatment of it. The Home Office, though, as far as we know, are continuing to fight this. So the case hasn't been conceded, as far as we know, and it's been referred back to the upper tribunal to presumably to go on and grant permission and deal with it. So it's an extraordinary kind of litany of things, but also quite interesting because it's quite important on this issue of whether human rights are engaged in entry clearance applications, the existence of private life through having lawful status, the fact that it doesn't lapse during this very long period abroad, and also disproving the SD Sri Lanka Entry Clearance Officer case from 2020. All the references are there in the blog post. So yeah, it's a really sad, appalling case, and also quite interesting, I think, from a legal point of view.
Okay, next one is me, and the article is: latest Home Office statistics show Vietnamese nationals are the government's likely next target. This was one of those ad hoc statistics release that the government have been doing sporadically, or Home Office have been releasing sporadically to support speeches made by the Prime Minister. And these statistics show that from April last year to 21st of April this year, 31,909 people were detected crossing the channel. 5,897 of those are Afghans. The grant rate is 99%. 2,964 were Eritrean people, grant rate 99%. 2,744 were Syrians, grant rate 99%. 1,898 were Sudanese, and the grant rate is 98%. So the point I am making there by setting all of that out is that these people should have better options to get here, and they do not. And that is why people make that journey and will continue to make that journey. The other point I made is that anyone who has arrived since the 7th of March last year, which I think is everyone in that cohort, yes, because it runs from April last year, they are currently prohibited from a grant of leave under Section 30 of the Illegal Migration Act, again, as you've heard me say over and over and over again. Perhaps at some point, the government will give an indication of what they intend to do with these people, apart from the 200 that they might be able to send to Rwanda.
Yeah, I think they're just going to be holding off as long as possible, aren't they? Because they've sort of tied themselves in such knots that any announcement now is billed as an amnesty. And it's just the whole thing is such a disaster area, sort of public policy.
No, I haven't finished.
Sure. Oh, haven't you? Sorry, Sonia. You paused for breath and I butted in, sorry.
The other thing I wanted to say was that the other thing recorded in the statistics is that we've seen a big rise in arrivals of Vietnamese nationals. And as I was looking at that, I noticed that there are actually quite a lot of similarities with the way that Albanian cases have been handled. The first point to note is that after British citizens, Albanians and Vietnamese are the two highest nationalities who are identified as potential victims of trafficking. Nationals of both countries can be and are, frequently recognized as refugees because of the risk of re-trafficking if they are returned to their home country. the UK has entered into cooperation agreements with both countries and has also amended the country policy information notes for survivors of trafficking from both of those countries. And we've seen what they've done with Albanians. And so this just seems like the same playbook has been used in relation to Vietnamese nationals. And it all seems geared up to send people back into very dangerous situations. So I just wanted to flag that up as something that people need to be aware of. And I think, you know, look at everything we've been writing up and everything that's been happening with Albanian cases, and just be aware that it's entirely possible the government could be doing the same thing with Vietnamese people.
Yeah, and to remind people, that's things like a target refusal rate of 98% and stuff. You know, it's just astonishing stuff that they did with Albanians. Okay, can I cover the next one there? So, okay. This one's a fairly quick one. So the blog post title is Somali Refugees Conviction for Possessing a False Identity Document Quashed by Court of Appeals. This is by Colin Gregory. And just very quickly, and this is it's a historic conviction. It goes back to 2010 under the Identity Cards Act, and it's basically use of a false document, as we said in the title. A couple of interesting things from this. One is the extension of time, which is more than 12 years, and the court accepted that basically it was okay to wait for a fresh claim to be decided before then challenging the conviction, and it took a long time for this fresh claim to actually sort of get accepted and decided and so on. And the other is to flag up the nationality good character requirement policy, which was actually quite important by the sounds of things from Colin's write-up of this, which was updated in July 2023, so that if you'll be refused citizenship forever if you've received a custodial sentence of 12 months or more. Whereas previously there was a kind of, it was effectively, you know, it's not formally under the spent convictions legislation, but it was effectively spent after 15 years, but now it's permanent. So, and that makes a criminal conviction much more significant in the long term. And Colin says that actually helped her with justifying the extension of time in this case. So yeah, there aren't hopefully too many of these cases still around. Obviously there are, you know, the Mateta case in the Court of Appeal is referenced here, which deals with this. And the courts have been pretty sympathetic where somebody's later established themselves to be a refugee. So it's another one of those, basically.
Next one is me, and I'm going to take this one quite briefly as well. Everyone will be happy to hear after my last couple. This is new route to be set up to reunite children separated from family in Afghanistan evacuations, and the Home Secretary breaches duty of candor again. So this was an unsuccessful challenge to family reunion processes in a case, this is just horrifying to contemplate. Half a family was evacuated from Afghanistan, and that was two children, I think, and were granted indefinite leave to remain in the UK, and the other half of the family were left in Afghanistan. The case is HR and others and Secretary of State for the Home Department. It was heard in the High Court. What is particularly interesting about this is that it was disclosed during the claim that apparently around 80 children were evacuated from Afghanistan and separated from their families. And a new route is going to be put in place to facilitate the reunion of these families shortly. I mean, I haven't seen it come out yet. And we are how many years after the evacuations now? I just, yeah, absolutely just horrifying to think about these poor families. But yeah, so that's that one. And then I wanted to mention another case from relating to Afghanistan, which is procedural fairness requires reasons to be given in Afghan resettlement refusals. So this was an appeal by the Home Secretary and Defense Secretary in an Afghan relocations and assistance policy known as ARAP case. The Court of Appeal dismissed the appeals and said that given the nature and significance of the eligibility decision, procedural fairness does require more than the simple giving of pro forma reasons to the effect that the applicant does not meet one of the conditions. And the reason they had to state that, which seems fairly common sense, is that previously Lane has said in the High Court that the system of providing pro forma decision letters stating that the applicant had not satisfied the relevant criteria was compatible with the common law duty of fairness. And he was wrong, the Court of Appeal have said. Big smile on your face there, Colin.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. So, in this case wipes that smile right off my face. So I felt pretty sick, frankly, reading this case. So the write-up, I did the write-up on this one. Supreme Court finds no human right to legal status. If it's your own fault, you can't be removed. So the case is AM Belarus, Secretary of State for the Home Department, 2024 UKSC 13. And the judgment is delivered by Lord Sales, which I think is is significant because the terms of the judgment, like I say, I felt a little bit ill reading parts of it. It's an extraordinary and really unusual set of facts. So perhaps shouldn't really spend too long on this because, you know, these kinds of facts don't come up very often. But basically, he's thought to be from Belarus. He arrives, I think, it's like the late 90s or something. And then an attempt is made to remove him in 2001 by the Home Office. But on arrival in Belarus, he claimed to the Belarusian authorities not to be Belarusian. And they refused to accept him. And he gets bounced back to the UK, basically. And since then, since 2001, he has continued to live in the UK. And he has continued, apparently, to obstruct efforts to redocument him as Belarusian and to remove him there. So he's been there. He's been here in the UK for an awfully long time now, since that removal. During that time, he's developed, perhaps unsurprisingly, pretty serious mental health issues. He's committed criminal offences, including an identity, false identity offence. Perhaps, again, unsurprisingly, he's got various addiction problems. His behaviour is such that he doesn't qualify under the 20-year rule, basically. So even though he's got more than 20 years of residence, legal or illegal, he doesn't qualify under the immigration rules. The question really was, is the Home Office obliged to grant him settlement or proper status after such a long period of time? And the answer basically was no from the Supreme Court. He had no proper status, basically. So he's on temporary admission or immigration bail latterly. He doesn't have leave to remain of any sort. And that's what he's seeking here. Ideally settlement, but, you know, some sort of proper legal status. So the Home Office say, well, it's his own fault, and we're therefore not obliged to grant him status. And essentially, the Supreme Court agrees to that. And if I kind of frame, if I repeat the framing of what they consider the issue to be, you can sort of see where they go with this and why I felt a little bit queasy. The question then is whether the United Kingdom, which has been forced by AM to act as his involuntary and unwilling host in this way, in violation of its own very strong public interest, is subject to a greater obligation under Article 8 to make further provision for him out of public funds and to allow him access to the employment market so that he can compete for jobs with citizens and lawful immigrants. And it's just like, that's the Supreme Court speaking. They're not saying that's the Home Office's, yeah, they're not repeating the Home Office line and saying that that's a lawful conclusion or whatever. That's you know, the voice of the Supreme Court. You know, another way of looking at it would be that he has to be maintained at public expense forevermore and is unable to contribute to society because he's been denied any kind of legal status. You know, you can frame the question rather differently if you want to, but that's the line that the Supreme Court decided to take. They hold that there's a very strong public interest in not in their terms, not rewarding somebody for their bad behavior because it would encourage others to do likewise. And the upper tribunal in the Court of Appeal had said, well, look, nobody's going to copy this guy because it's his existence has been so miserable and it's such an unusual set of facts. Supreme Court disagrees and says, you know, there's this kind of hypothetical deterrent effect. He has to be punished, basically, to stop other people from going through the same thing and doing the same thing to themselves. And also, there's a very strong public interest in removal, generally, basically, and they sort of reiterate that. So despite this guy succeeding in the upper tribunal and the Court of Appeal, the Supreme Court reversed that decision. And a sort of conclusion, it's instructive on there being no human right to status, basically. So, you know, we were talking earlier about limbo. This is a bit different. Well, arguably very different because it's somebody who's been actively resisting removal, basically. But no matter how long, apparently, you're then left in the country, if you have actively resisted removal, you'll never get a right to legal status under human rights law, essentially. It will be different if you cannot be removed, I think. You know, that's not the situation that was applicable here. So if you just, you know, the Home Office tries to remove you but can't because the other country won't accept you back or something like that, not through your own fault, not through your own actions, but where you're actively resisting removal, there's no human right to have your limbo status resolved or to have legal status. And they refer to the sort of key case on this from 2010, the Mendizabal against France case in Strasbourg. And, you know, we sort of end that blog post by pointing out that the Illegal Migration Act if it's brought into force, which is, as Sonia repeatedly and rightly says, it's not at the moment, but if brought into force, that does include a kind of what looks like a get-out clause for the government, where if it will be a breach of your human rights, you can be granted status, because there's a general bar on ever being granted status if the act applies to you. But actually, that's pretty narrow, because there isn't a human right to be granted status if you resist removal. So on that rather unhappy note, on to the next item.
Okay, so the next one is another briefing. This one is on how to make a change of conditions application and remove the no recourse to public funds restriction. This is written by Kaz Hatem at the Unity Project, who is one of my favorite people, and that is my favorite charity. This is a really detailed briefing looking at who can make the application. That is relevant, particularly since the recent case, which we discussed a few podcasts ago, which found that the Home Office cannot restrict the ability to lift the no recourse condition to certain applications. Any application can have the no recourse to public funds restriction lifted from it. Obviously, it's not as straightforward as that. But yeah, so Kaz explains who can make those applications, how to make the applications, and she also looks at Home Office decision making. And on the latter point, there has been an interesting development on delays, which we published an article on this week. And so I'll cover that next month in more detail. Next, we are moving on to deportation, and the article is Court of Appeal dismisses appeal against deportation by woman who has lived in the UK since 1985. This one is really infuriating. I was quite tempted to also give it to Colin to cover, but I wanted to make a specific point. In this case, the woman was sentenced to less than 4 years, and she has lived in the UK for almost 40 years. Her husband, who was convicted alongside her for mortgage fraud, and her children are all British and they all live here. She does not speak English very well, and yet was forced to represent herself in the upper tribunal with the assistance of her son after an adjournment request was refused. She had just found new solicitors, but they needed more time to be able to take the appeal on. The point I wanted to make is that I really recommend that people go and read the comments under this article. The appellant's instructing solicitor has provided some important context in there, which I think makes it even more of a depressing outcome. He explains a lot more about their attempts to get the hearing adjourned. And he also makes the point that she is criticized for not integrating into UK society, yet she is convicted of significant and complex mortgage fraud, which presumably involved some paperwork. Those two things don't seem to sit very well together. I'm really glad that he put that comment in there, because it made me think a lot more about it, and it made it, yeah, even more depressing.
Yeah, although I get, you might not be able to answer this, I'm not sure, but you said that this was doing the rounds with the far right at one point. What was going on? How do you know about that?
Oh, I think they quote tweeted a tweet from Free Movement account. I think that was how I found out. Yes. And yeah, it was ugly, really ugly stuff.
Lovely. Okay. So now you unfortunately for me, you've given me an absolute nightmare case. It's very ably written up by Nick Mason, but it is a inherently very complicated subject. And I just don't think I can really go through the whole thing in detail, because it's too involved. So it's to do with deportation of EU nationals. So the blog post title is Upper Tribunal Provides Guidance on the Deportation of EU Nationals for Pre-Brexit Conduct. Although I think one of the cases actually post-Brexit conduct. And the sort of short story is that whether the old, much more generous EU rules apply to you and to whether you get to stay in the UK, or the sort of conventional domestic UK law regime applies to you, in which case you probably don't stand much of a chance, is basically dictated by the way that the Home Office decides your case. And that depends to a significant degree on whether you had already gotten recognised status under the old regulations, the EA regulations, and or had made an application under the EU settlement scheme. So I don't think I can really go too much further than that in sort of trying to spell it all out. There is a lengthy headnote that we've got at the bottom of the post that sort of tries to explain. What I will very quickly do, though, is just look at, I think I'll pick a couple of the sets of facts. So this was several cases that had been joined together in order to try and deal with all this and give proper guidance on it. So the first one is Abdullah, who's a Dutch citizen, arrives in 2008, convicted of serious offence in 2021, but the criminal conduct took place 2 years earlier in 2019. He'd made an EUSS application in 2021 before the end of the grace period, which was then refused a bit later on. And there were two rights of appeal in this case, one under the 2002 Act, a sort of conventional one, against refusal of the human rights claim, and the other under the regulations for withdrawal from the EU and so on. And the correct sequence, according to tribunal in this one, was to consider if or when he was exercising treaty rights prior to the 31st of December 2020, and or whether he'd acquired permanent residence prior to the 31st of December 2020. And if either of those was made out, then he'd come within the scope of the withdrawal agreement, and it would therefore be the EEA regulations which governed his deportation. If he didn't come within either of those conditions, then it would be necessary to ask whether he was resident prior to the 31st of December 2020, and if so, was it for a continuous period of 5 years? And if so, then he would be covered by the EUSS and again would benefit from the enhanced protection of the EU regime. But otherwise, he wouldn't. So that's one of the cases. I'm going to skip the other one and then skip to the end to the Rudikas case, which essentially it looks like. So I think the first case, it looks like he stood a pretty good chance, basically. The Rudikas case, less so. So he's a national of Lithuania in the UK since 2005, granted status under the settlements EUSS in January 2020. 13th of July 2022, he's convicted of several offences, which he'd started in 2021, gets notified in 2022 of intention to deport him, appeals on Article 8 grounds, and it's allowed. But the upper tribunal basically overrules that and says that that was the wrong approach. So it was going to be reheard by the tribunal, that one, but it looks like just on human rights grounds rather than under the EEA regulation. So it looked from Nick's write-up like he wasn't going to succeed. Anyway, it's a useful reference point. If you are dealing with these cases, then that headnote's going to be very important. Nick's summary of the facts, I think, are useful and instructive. And yeah. Take a look.
I seem to recall Nick also saying he had a nightmare with that one. So you're not alone.
To be fair to the upper tribunal, not words that you'll often hear me say, this is just an absolute mess of legislation and rights. And yeah, it's a total sort of dog's dinner, basically.
Next, on to citizenship. And I'm just going to briefly mention the Independent Chief Inspector's report on deprivation of citizenship shows a high number of stalled cases. I was kind of surprised to hear from at least two people saying that they found this really useful, because I was like, this is some niche stuff. But essentially, I think the thing that people found useful is if you have a case that falls within the Court of Appeals decision in Lacey, which I've just realized I may not be pronouncing correctly at all, then this article essentially explains why your client has not received a decision. They've been waiting on a ministerial submission for some time now. We wrote up Lacey in 2021, and the headline for that article, for anyone who needs a refresher, is "Man Who Won British Citizenship by Fraud Gets to Keep It Thanks to Home Office Inaction," which I think pretty much explains what those cases are all about. The one other point from this report that I wanted to mention, because it is quite amusing / horrifying, is the Home Office, they record their work in progress, or they were recording their work in progress on a spreadsheet. And they had 77 cases recorded as the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which just doesn't really inspire much confidence as to their handling of anything. But there we are. That's what's going on in the Home Office deprivation of citizenship team.
Yeah, and presumably ministers just have got other stuff to do. And there's been sort of ministerial churn. And I think we saw in one of these inspection reports, didn't we, that basically they'd stopped giving ministers stuff because they were so overwhelmed. Ministers were so overwhelmed. And so this stuff is just parked, basically, because they're doing other things.
I think there is a large, large element of not wanting to take a decision that they don't want to take, yet they have to take. So I think that is the case with a lot of this. They are going to have to do something which they don't want to do. And so they are just not doing it. They're sticking their head in the sand.
And leave it to the next government.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's the same thing with this Illegal Migration Act cohort who can't be granted leave. They know they have to do something. They know what they have to do, because there is literally no other choice than to grant these people leave. But they are just avoiding actually doing it. And I'm sure it's the same situation here.
Yeah. And in the citizenship deprivation case, it's awful for the people concerned. But there's should be not much wider cost to the public purse, because we're not talking about a large number of people and they're not in asylum accommodation. Whereas with the Illegal Migration Act stuff, all those people in limbo, you know, they're on asylum support. You know, this inaction is costing an absolute fortune. It's incredible they're getting away with it. Okay, anyway, there's a very quick mention for a new OISC code of practice has been published and it will take effect from the 1st of September 2024. I'm not going to go into that in any detail, just sort of flag up if you are an OISC advisor, you should make sure you've taken a look at that and you need to read it through, understand it. There's various different sort of bits of guidance and so on the OISC is doing. But that's it's quite a major change, I think it'd be fair to say. It's a much more modern approach, much more in line with solicitors and barristers, a much more kind of purposive approach to guidance rather than being very prescriptive. It's all about sort of principles and so on. So it is a change. Some people are going to be uncomfortable about that, but you know, it's fairly normal in the rest of the legal sector. But yeah, you do need to take a look if it applies to you.
While we're on OISC, I'm also just going to flag up that I am teaching what I think is our next live training course for OISC Level 1. That starts, I think, mid-July, and there are a couple of places left. So do book those sooner rather than later if you want to come and join me.
Yeah, they do tend to sell out quite a long way in advance, those. We're sort of looking at whether we can provide more courses or something. Yeah, you need to, when we release those, you do need to move quite quickly. They do sell out.
Then I'm just going to mention under EU, we've had a case from the Upper Tribunal. Upper Tribunal confirms that appellants lost their rights under EU law once a sponsor lost his EU citizenship. I mean, it seems a little bit obvious to me. It's entirely possible I'm missing something. I am by no means any sort of EU law expert. But I can't imagine this arises too often, that EU sponsor lost his EU citizenship and his family members were then, unsurprisingly to me, unable to rely on him for EU law residence rights. There was an issue about whether an expulsion decision had been made or not. But I mean, like, this man was no longer an Austrian citizen. It was a bit baffling to me. I imagine this is a niche situation. Finally, I just wanted to mention that we updated in April all three of our main Appendix FM briefings, which are: what are the financial requirements for UK spouse and partner visas, exceptional circumstances in a spouse or partner visa application under Appendix FM, and how to apply for a UK spouse or partner visa. These are often there are articles of ours that are viewed constantly, and we updated it to account for all the changes that happened in April, mainly the increase of the minimum income requirement. Anyway, just flagging up that was done in April as well.
And I think at some point we'll have a recording of the webinar that we did on this as well, that Barry did for us. It was so well attended, that one.
He was amazing. He just, the Q&A at the end, I've never seen anything like it. It was like an absolute wonder to behold. I don't think you get that if you get the recording, but wow.
No, because we're making the recordings available, but there's a delay before we've kind of uploaded them and edited them and so on. And we edit out the Q&A to sort of give people an incentive to actually book onto the live thing, basically. Yeah, I think we're probably working on that in the background somewhere, but it's, you know, the recordings aren't as much of a priority for us, quite frankly, but we will get that on the website at some point.
Well, that's it. That was April. It was pretty rubbish month.
Yeah, well, let's hope May is better, although I don't think either is terribly optimistic about these things, and with good reason.
Thanks, everyone, and we will catch you next month.
Bye.